Chapter 1. As I stared out at our beached ship from the tree line of the jungle, I wondered just how much of a head start the orcs had on us. It had only been about a day since Tyrion spotted their fleet heading due southwest, directly toward the Isle of the Dragons, and, more importantly, toward being one step closer to ultimate victory. If the orcs were somehow able to reawaken the dragons inside of the sleeping volcano and then bond them with their grotesque excuse for a species, it was all over. The orcs were destructive enough with just their large numbers, iron weapons, and sheer brute tendencies. Adding a freaking miniature army of flying, fire-breathing dragons to that list would make them practically unstoppable. And we needed to stop them before they became unstoppable. However, that wasn't going to happen anytime soon if we didn't get the holes in our boat patched up.
I'm still not convinced the Morpho people know much about ships,
Mira whispered to me as we watched the butterfly women at a distance. The Morpho women had agreed to go out and inspect the damage on our boat, mainly to see if there was anything they could do to fix it. Even though I knew the sort of materials we would need, I wasn't as familiar with the island as they were, and I wasn't sure if there was even anything here that would act similarly. It doesn't matter if they know much about ships, I reminded the beautiful golden-scale dragonkin woman. As long as they can identify what it takes to repair those holes, I'll be as happy as a lark.
What's a lark?
Gemma, the tall auburn-haired deer woman, questioned with a tilt of her head.
And why are they so happy all the time?
They're... I turned to the Nurlope woman and raised my finger to explain, but then I quickly spaced out. Actually, I'm not 100% sure. I know it's some type of animal back in my world, but I'm not sure if it's a bird or a rodent or a small mammal or what. All I know is they sound really happy, so people like to use that expression.
If you haven't noticed,
Mira chuckled.
We don't have many happy animals in our world.
You could say that again, I agreed. I think the only animals I've encountered that didn't just straight up try to kill me were George, Tyrion, and their kind. And they're dragons.
And that's only because they were babies.
The stoic dragonkin warrior Sela reminded me with a stern nod.
Had they been full-grown dragons, the experience would have gone similarly to what happened on the Kunag Island.
That's the silver lining in all of this, I suppose. I sighed as I looked out at the rest of the crew down on the beach. If the orcs somehow do get to the dragons before we do, and they don't have any idea on how to do the rebonding ceremony, it's going to cause mass chaos.
Perhaps the dragons will go on a rampage and smite all our enemies before we can even intervene?
Sela suggested. The old Indiana Jones route, eh? I mused, though I knew none of them understood the reference. As much as I'd love to bank on divine intervention saving our butts, I'm not going to hold my breath. I turned my attention back to the shipwreck, where the Morpho women were all fluttering around the hull under the power of their large, multicolored butterfly wings. Queen Dalwyn and the youngest of the Morphos, Elzara, inspected the largest of the holes in the ship, and I could see from all the way back here the monarch of the Morphos was softly pointing out the damage to the ship, while Elzara observed curiously. The blue-haired beauty of a butterfly woman was always inquisitive, though she was also a bit too innocent for her own good. Meanwhile, Dalwyn was a great leader who oozed nothing but regality and leadership. I'd made love to both of them in the recent days, and I couldn't help but wonder if they now had my children growing inside of them. Both of them were going to make excellent mothers, though I wasn't sure quite yet if my seed had taken with either of them. Oh well. Either way, I wanted to keep trying, possibly multiple times a day, if that's what it took. The other Morpho women were currently hovering around various parts of the ship. Ahuara, formerly the de facto leader of the Morpho people, floated next to the sheepish Zarandri and the beautiful green-winged Kandara. Meanwhile, Olara, the wild woman of this particular Morpho tribe, was zipping around the crow's nest with the energy of a squirrel who'd taken too much Red Bull. What the hell is Olara doing? I laughed and pointed to the darting purple-haired Morpho.
Perhaps she's excited by the prospect of sailing?
Mira shrugged.
It sounds like these women haven't left the island in several rotation cycles. And you've just given them the chance to leave,
Gemma added.
I know I was excited to get off my island, especially with the danger of the wargs and the orcs and all the other creatures that wanted to eat us, capture us, and kill us.
Chill, Gemma. I could see the Nurlope was letting her nerves get to her, so I placed my hand on her face tenderly. You're with us now, and I'll never let anyone hurt you, or our child. I placed my other hand against Gemma's belly as I tried to console her, and she responded with a happy sigh. The auburn-haired beauty was only a few months along in her pregnancy, and her stomach was just now beginning to protrude into a slight bump. Even though she was adamant about coming along with me on all of my adventures, I sometimes worried about how I was going to keep her safe. Thankfully, that was what Tyrion was for. The little silver dragon was currently down on the beach with the water dragon Malky and my son, Arik. Malky and Arik raced along the shore of the ocean while Tyrion darted through the air beside them, and though their legs carried them fast, the water dragon and the dragon prince were no match for Tyrion's wings. Tyrion gave his friends a mischievous look before he faced forward, beat his wings intensely, and then shot ahead of the pack by several feet. Although Malky and my son both tried to increase their pace and catch up with their scaly airborne friend, they didn't stand a chance. Finally, Tyrion slowed to a hover, spun around, and then made a few taunting motions with his wings while the other two tried to catch their breaths. Not 10 feet away from the racer's finish line, Nadir and Lezan stood facing the tree line of the forest, and both of the Kunag women had their sharp stone axes in their hands as they took aim at a nearby tree. Then Lezan hoisted her axe up with both hands behind her head, let out a huff, and brought it forward. The axe spun end over end as it flew across the beach and then slammed into the trunk of the tree with a dull thunk. Bits of dark brown bark splintered in every direction in a solid mist, and the axe remained lodged in the tree. Lezan held up both of her hands and danced excitedly around Nadir as the other Kunag woman lined up her shot. Even though she had a multicolored hair raccoon woman doing what looked like an Irish jig right in her face, Nadir didn't flinch. Instead, the leader of the Kunag heaved her massive weapon at the tree with a loud grunt that echoed across the beach. Her axe rocketed directly toward the same spot as Lezan's and struck into the trunk just a few inches above. Lezan's dancing instantly ceased, and her face fell into a moody frown. Then she crossed her arms over her big, firm breasts as she stared down her leader and flicked her tail back and forth like an anxious cat. Meanwhile, Nadir just walked toward the axe-ridden tree, looked back over her shoulder, and mocked her friend with a smirk. Nadir strutted up the beach until she reached the tree line, and then she reached out and took the hilt of each axe with her hands. Next, she yanked them out with a single heave and held them up behind her neck like a dual-wielding badass. Damn. Just when I thought the raccoon women couldn't get any sexier, they went and did something like that. The last member of my crew, Jonas, had moved a bunch of seashells into a circle in the sand. He sat at their very center with his back to me, and his legs were crossed with his hands firmly on his knees. Our resident soothsayer seemed to always be in a constant state of meditation. Then again, if it helped him see into the future and figure out what laid ahead on our journey, I wasn't going to complain. Still, even though I trusted Jonas with my life, I was still very nervous about this rebonding ceremony. The Dragonkin soothsayer claimed it would take a very long time for the ceremony to take hold on the slumbering beasts inside the volcano, and that was something we didn't have a lot of. Not to mention, there were a million things that could go wrong. If the ceremony was interrupted, or if the bond didn't quite take with the Morpho women, we would have a whole pack of full-grown, fire-breathing dragons who would not only be pissed off, but also confused and looking to protect themselves and their nestmates. Honestly, I'd almost prefer fighting the whole fleet of orcs.
Are you all right, Draco Rex?
Sela's stoic voice interrupted my thoughts.
You look troubled.
I asked as my mind was brought back to the present. I'm fine. I'm just nervous about the rebonding ceremony.
There are a lot of things that could go wrong.
Sela nodded. Thanks for the words of encouragement, I joked to the mossy-scaled warrior.
Oh, you know how this one is.
Mira chuckled as she put her arm around Sela's neck.
She's never shy when it comes to saying what's on her mind.
Honesty is the best policy,
Sela retorted.
You should try it sometimes.
Even though it had become more of a norm in the recent days, I still wasn't used to seeing Sela and Mira so chummy. From the first moment I met these two beautiful dragonkin women, they seemed to be rivals who were always at each other's throats. When they realized they both wanted me, however, that was when things got even crazier. Honestly, there were moments when I wondered if I was going to have to pull them apart catfight style. Thankfully, I put an end to all of that when I made them both share my cock at the same time. Ever since said incident, Mira and Sela have been more like friendly rivals, frenemies who crack jokes at each other's expense, but who always did so in jest.
There's so much that could go wrong,
Gemma noted as she twirled a finger through her long auburn hair.
I've been trying not to think about it, but Tyrion won't stop thinking about it either. I think he might even be more worried than I am.
Trust me, I shuddered. Nobody's more nervous about this than me. Except maybe Jonas. But he does a really good job at hiding his emotions, so it's hard to tell for sure.
Unfortunately, that's how most of our great soothsayers were,
Mira explained.
They were kind men with very powerful abilities, but they concealed all of their fears and doubts. There was even one instance where the soothsayer refused to tell us what he saw in his vision.
Knowing Nerissa, I'm sure that didn't fly, I mused.
It didn't,
Sela added somewhat somberly.
But when he finally revealed what he saw in his vision, we all regretted pushing him so hard.
What did he see? I now had to know. Mira and Sela looked at each other with sadness in their eyes, but then they continued on.
He saw the battle with the orcs.
Mira sighed.
The battle where all of our men were slain by those fuckers of mothers.
And that didn't make your people try to change the outcome? I gasped.
They did.
Sela shook her head.
A warrior's trained harder than before, built and stockpiled weapons. In the end, it didn't make a difference.
So, what? I asked. Does that mean the visions of a soothsayer always come true?
As far as I can tell,
the blue-haired dragonkin woman admitted.
There has yet to be a prediction they've made that hasn't come true.
Then I really hope Jonas is seeing good things down there. I gulped. Actually, I think it's about time for me to go down and check in on him. I wandered down out of the tree line as my boots clomped through the sandy turf. The three women were right behind me, though their footfalls seemed to be a little more delicate, and soon we were standing just outside Jonas's circle of seashells. Hello, my friends, the soothsayer noted without so much as opening an eye. How may I assist you? We want to know what sort of visions are coming to you, I admitted. Have you seen anything about our sleeping dragons? Jonas opened his eyes, and I found myself staring into his sage-green peepers. His pupils were dilated, as if he were on some sort of stimulant, yet his entire demeanor seemed tense and relaxed, all at the same time. What made my heart fall into my stomach, however, was the perplexed expression that spread across his face.
I think so, the soothsayer admitted. I see fire. Lots and lots of fire.
That's not necessarily a bad thing, I said as I tried to think about the positives. Maybe you're just seeing the smoldering remains of the Orc Island after we fly out there with our badass army of fire-breathing dragons.
Maybe,
Gemma gasped with wide eyes.
Or maybe he's seeing the result of a failed ceremony, just like we feared.
Is there anyone in these visions, Jonas?
Mira implored.
I didn't see any physical figures, the elderly soothsayer continued. But I did hear a voice. A voice that sounded an awful lot like Ben's.
See?
Mira chuckled and slapped my shoulder happily.
It sounds like whatever it is he's seen, you're alive and well. Maybe it's not so bad after all.
Maybe, I admitted. But if the only voice he can hear is mine, then what does that mean for the rest of my crew? For all I know, you could all be barbecued by the damn dragons, and all Jonas is hearing are my cries of agony.
I'm afraid that's all I can see, Jonas sighed. I wish I could be of more help, Draco Rex, but I'm afraid I cannot control what visions the gods bestow upon me.
It's all right, Jonas, I reassured the man with the pepper hair. Trust me, you've been more help than you could ever possibly imagine. The soothsayer's eyes grew happy from my comment, but our moment was soon interrupted by the faint pitter-patter of feet against the sand.
Dad!
Eric called out as he barreled toward us.
Dad! Guess what just happened?
What happened, Eric? I turned to face my son as he, Malky, and Tyrion all headed our way.
I beat Tyrion in a foot race!
The Dragon Prince boasted proudly through huffs of breath.
He tried to use his wings to outrun us, but I was too fast for him.
Is that so? I skeptically raised an eyebrow at the Silver Dragon, who froze in place.
Yep,
Tyrion proclaimed via our dragon bond.
Arik beat me and Malky completely under the power of his own legs. I definitely didn't slow myself down so he'd stand a chance at winning. I didn't either,
Malky protested. Of course, I could tell both of them were lying. I'd seen Malky and Tyrion both running at full speed before, and they both made even my enhanced muscles look like they were a child's. They almost certainly let my son win a race or two just so he could say he had. And for that, I was immensely grateful. Arik may have just been a kid, but he was also the future king of the Dragonkin people. He needed to taste the adversity of defeat every now and again, but he also needed to savor the sweet nectar of victory when it presented itself. And unfortunately, for a child of his stature, victory didn't come often. I gave both the dragons a knowing nod before I turned back to my son. That's awesome, Arik! I grinned and rubbed his silver locks. If anyone could beat two dragons in a race, it'd be the future Draco Rex.
I have you to thank, Dad,
Arik chuckled.
Even though Mom might say differently, I definitely get a lot of my best traits from you.
I didn't know whether to be happy by that comment or offended. Either way, I didn't have much time to think about it, because the Morpho women were returning from their inspection.
Good news, my loyal friends,
Queen Dalwyn's angelic voice announced as they all fluttered down to the ground.
The boat can most certainly be repaired.
That's great news! I clapped my hands together excitedly. What's the diagnosis? Do we need to just cut down some trees and start shaping? Or is this going to be a more intensive repair?
I hope not,
Mira grumbled.
The orcs already have about a day on us, so I'd hate to stay landlocked any longer than we already have.
In all honesty,
the orange-haired Ahuara spoke up.
I've seen much worse damage before on our dwellings. It can probably be repaired with a bit of colossi sap, and then reinforced with our throat silk.
I'm not going to lie, I shook my head with amusement. I have no idea what most of those words even mean.
Throat silk is what we use to create our cocoons,
the golden-haired Kandara noted in a spaced-out tone.
It's a naturally occurring substance that gets as hard as a rock when it dries out. It's also what we use to make our houses.
Wait, I prompted. Those entire hanging villages were built out of stuff that came out of your mouths.
Throat silk, Benjamin,
the green-winged Morpho chuckled.
It's one of the most versatile materials on the entire island.
Then why do you need the... what did you call it?
Sela interjected.
Colossi sap?
Oh!
The blue-haired, innocent Elzara giggled and raised her hand.
I know this one. The throat silk is just for the structure, but the colossi sap is what makes it waterproof. The throat silk also works to harden the sap more quickly.
Very good, Elzara.
Dalwyn smirked like a proud teacher as she flipped her neon yellow hair over her shoulder.
The sap is so thick that when it dries, it creates a waterproof seal. It's what we use on our weapons so our enemy's blood doesn't ruin the leather.
I'm sure you remember what happens when you encounter throat silk structures without any sort of waterproof sap.
Ahuara noted with a smug look.
You all had first-hand experience.
Trust me. I shuddered as I thought back to how all the Morpho dwellings collapsed during the last rainstorm. I remember how bad it was.
Maybe I'm not quite following.
Gemma spoke up curiously.
Why didn't you just coat all of your houses in the sap if it made them waterproof?
The Morpho women looked at Gemma like she had a third eye, and then they all burst out into fits of laughter.
Do you have any idea how difficult it is to get sap out of a colossi tree?
The purple-haired Halara chuckled as she held up her fan blade.
As much as we love these weapons, there's nothing when you try to pierce the hide of the great colossi.
The bark of the colossi tree is almost a foot thick.
The shy, timid Zarandri noted as she blew a red lock out from her eye.
It takes us hours just to carve a hole large enough to get a few drops of sap.
Oh, fuck. I grumbled under my breath. We don't really have any extra hours to spend. I mulled it over for a second as I tried to think of any particular solutions. At first, I wondered if Tyrion could just use his fire breath to knock over one of these trees, but then I quickly realized that, if done incorrectly, his breath could set ablaze to the entire trunk. That would, at best, burn up the sap, and at worst, set fire to the entire forest around us. Then I wondered if our sea glass weapons would do any good against the thickness of the bark, but that notion quickly came and went. Our spears, daggers, and arrows were all made as piercing weapons, and weren't really much use when you wanted to chop down a damn tree. Even my sword, though sturdy, probably didn't have enough oomph to break through the armor-like hide of the colossi tree. However, the light bulb went on in my head when I heard the sound of Nadir's axe slam against a nearby tree. The Kunag women. Their axes were made out of thick, hard stone, and they were intentionally created as bludgeoning or chopping weapons. Not to mention, both Nadir and Lazan loved to just Hulk smash with their axes until their little hearts were content. If there were any members of my crew who could fell a giant colossi tree, it would be those two. Lazan! Nadir! I called out to the Kunag women, who were still engrossed in their game of axe toss. However, they both stopped in place the second they heard my voice, and then they looked over and hurried to our position.
Are we finally going on the move?
Nadir bounced.
There were only so many times I could best Lazan in tree target before it started to get boring. You weren't besting me.
Lazan scoffed and put her hands on her hips.
In fact, we were tied at the end there. There is no need to deny the inevitable.
The raven-haired Kunag leader dismissed.
Malak is the only one who's ever actually beat me, and that's because she cheats. Outside of her, I'm undefeated.
How exactly does she cheat? I questioned. It seems like a very straightforward game. Nadir pursed her lips, crossed her arms across her chest, and then shook her head. But instead of providing an explanation, she just chuckled.
She just does.
The Kunag leader stated matter-of-factly.
I can't explain it, but that gray-haired rapscallion always beats me by a few ticks. Literally, one time, her axe was one half of a claw closer to the center than mine. I don't know how she does it, but Malak cheats.
Mira, Sela, and I all exchanged knowing glances, though we didn't say anything. Tell you what, guys, I chuckled. It sounds like you might have some pent-up frustrations you need to take out.
Always?
Lazan smirked devilishly. Well, I continued, we've got a task for you. There are these giant trees that will give us the sap we need to patch up the Dragon Queen. However, it's trapped behind a bunch of bark that's really, really thick. So I was thinking...
You want us to bludgeon it with our axes until the sap spills out like warm blood?
Nadir grinned unnervingly. Yes, I nodded, though I was a bit creeped out by her overzealousness. That's exactly what we need you to do. Lazan and Nadir both began to bounce up and down on the balls of their feet like overexcited toddlers.
Show us these trees,
Lazan demanded as she pulled her axe from its sheath and held it in both her hands.
We will smash them. The sooner we get there, the better.
Don't be impatient, my friends,
Queen Dalwin warned.
We need to figure out how much colossi sap we need first, as well as how we are going to transport it.
How do you normally transport the stuff?
Mira pondered aloud.
I thought you said you used it all the time.
We usually don't transport it,
Ahuara noted.
Normally, we just whittle down the bark until we can use the spines of our fan blade to prick a hole through the weak part. Then, once it's leaking, we just let the drops splash out onto the leather.
What about a tree leaf?
Gemma suggested.
The leaves of your trees around here are nearly the size of my whole body. So, wouldn't that be enough to hold the sap we need?
Perhaps,
Dalwin pondered.
Although, the trees are a bit deeper into the forest, and trying to carry the leaves for that long could prove difficult.
The leaves are a good idea, though,
Zarandri noted, but her small green eyes didn't look up from the ground.
Especially if it's the waxy kind. Those are thick enough to hold water.
That's when it hit me. Each of the women made excellent points. The leaves themselves weren't the best idea due to their general flimsiness. Sure, they were perfect for holding water or other runny liquids, but it sounded like this sap was a lot more viscous than what they normally carried. However, the waxy leaves wouldn't drip whatsoever, and that was a huge plus. All we needed to do was make it so the leaves had a firm form, and I knew just how to do that. "Follow me," I announced as I motioned for my friends to follow. "I have a plan." I turned around and headed back to the tree line, where I found the closest tree that looked like it had waxy leaves, and like most of the flora and fauna of this island, the tree before me was about 6 times as large as the ones on my world or on any of the other islands we'd seen so far. Its trunk was about 4 times the width of my body, and it towered over me like a skyscraper. Several thinner branches popped out from the trunk all the way up its height, and each one bore leaves that were at least the size of my own figure. We would only need one of these leaves to get the job done, but getting one down was going to literally be a tall order. Thankfully, we had 2 members of our crew who were expert climbers.
"What's the plan, Draco Rex?"
Sella asked like a good soldier. "I need one of those giant-ass leaves," I explained. "If somebody wants to..."
"Last one there's an acorn holder!"
Lazan cackled as she ran toward the trunk. I watched as the black and white-haired woman sprang into the air, went spread-eagle, and then stabbed her claws into the bark of the tree. Nadir was right behind her, and the 2 Kunag women scurried up the giant structure like they were kids trying to scale to the top of the slide. Thanks to her head start, Lazan got there first, and the second she arrived next to the branch, she held onto the trunk tight with one arm, produced her axe with the other, and took a mighty swing at the thinner log of wood. Her blow struck true, though it only went about halfway through into the branch. Then, in a single swift motion, Nadir whipped out her axe, twirled it around in her right hand, and finished off Lazan's cut with a forceful swing. There was a sharp snap as the branch fell free of its base, and then it began to plummet downward, straight toward all of us, with nothing in between.